Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. We are grateful to be here with you for this Thanksgiving Eve on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. This morning we hear from Governor Josh Green with a list of hot topics to discuss. Housing discrimination cases may be tougher to pursue as federal protections over sexual orientation are relaxed. And we give thanks for quite a year in pro ball. For the first time, a Hawaii-born player takes the helm of a big league baseball team. And as we count our blessings, what's the line? You don't know what you got till it's gone. A jumping flea reminds us we are blessed to live in Hawaii. Nei. Taimani joins us to express gratitude through her music.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Governor Josh Green sat down with us this morning. He's just back from a meeting in Arizona with the Western Governors Association. That was top of mind. And the talks with the military on land leases, also a priority. And since we last talked to him, the Justice Department is pushing in on a cruise lawsuit challenging Hawaii's green fee to offset the impact of tourism on the environment. And this month, the messy water situation on Maui reached a crescendo. East and West Maui water issues spilled over at the Water Commission and at the State Land Board. Here's Governor Green. You've just come back, though, from this most recent meeting with the Western Governors Association. What's top of mind for you that you want to underscore for people to know?
That was an interesting meeting because I was the moderator of a panel for RFK Jr., and everyone was jazzed up thinking it would just be a bloodbath, but that's not what I'm about. I'm trying to make sure people get to have good public health. And so we had a really good discussion. We disagree incredibly on vaccinations, but we agree that chronic disease has to be managed better and nutrition has to be handled better. And we agree totally on pesticides and how they need to be regulated so they don't hurt kids. So it was good. And usually what happens in a talk like that where I give a little bit of an intro and then the principal, in this case it was RFK Jr., gives a short speech, then questions get moderated by, in this case, the governor, and it was me. It was good because we were able to establish from his mouth that they don't intend to change the schedule for vaccinations. And if any changes occur, they will still be covered. People will still get their vaccinations if their doctor recommends them. And that's all I ever cared about, which is, if a person's pediatrician or family doc or internist makes recommendations, it should be between that person and their patient, and it should be fair and it should be covered. So it was very good to hear him get on the record in that way. People were a little surprised I didn't take any poisonous shots because of the conflicts that have occurred between the two of us, but that's not really who I am. And I'm trying to set an example, to be frank. Whoever the next president is, Democrat or Republican after this era, I want them to be someone that kind of brings us together and heals these wounds that have occurred. So that's where I am right now. I'm on a mission to do that. And these large conferences give me an opportunity.
We have to find common ground. It's fine to disagree, but we have to have civil discourse. And so where we can work to see what can we agree on and move on from there.
Exactly. And there's a lot. I have one more gathering. I've been asked by George W. Bush to come with five other governors and spend 2 days talking about education. I'm going to do that on my way to Chicago, and then I'll be back essentially for good or for a long time through the State of the State address. And I continue to believe that we can find common ground, maybe 90% of what we do in our country's common ground. It's actually the reason that we can have even a civilized discussion with the military about the leases, about the land that they had suggested they would take through condemnation, but we were able to cool that off. And it's now going to be a discussion. As you know, I appointed this advisory council, mostly of incredibly strong Hawaiian leaders, like people like Bill Isla and Noi Noi Wong, Kali Watson, great people. I think the executive director at OHA is on it. And it's a great group of people. so that we can spend 2026 talking about what it would look like if the military needed to take action for national security on the land. And if they do, our values and needs have to be met in Hawaii. And that means things like cleaning up the land, getting Makua Valley back, making sure we have housing dollars and energy dollars. So when you hear about these discussions, and I know people on the far extremes of the political spectrum get very animated about this, they need to know that I have to be responsible and work with, in this case, the current administration, but also at the exact same time, fight for what's right for us. And that's an interesting dance because it's a pretty volatile time in Washington.
We do understand that these talks are sensitive. The military, the Army, would like a deal sooner than later, even though the leases aren't up for a couple of years. But there are folks in the community that feel strongly, yes, cleanup is imperative when we're talking about Makua Valley and anywhere else that the military has trained. And while the Army is willing to reduce its footprint in Makua, I know there are some that are really towing the line where they just want them out of the valley completely.
Yeah, I'd like that too, honestly. And that's one of the things that I've heard from the Hawaiian community and I respect immensely. So that is part of the proposal, to get all of Makua Valley back. And there might be a small, like a sliver that nobody wants to manage because it's so expensive and impossible. But the purpose of these discussions is to get Makua Valley back, to have 12,000 acres on Big Island returned to us, to shrink the footprint of the training areas at Pohakuloa, to do more clean energy projects, to clean up all the munitions, to have money for that. So we're on, believe me, the same page. There are a few people, and I'm not going to disrespect them, who say the military has to leave the state of Hawaii forever. I don't think that's a realistic position, but I do think that we can definitely have a, you know, much more balanced relationship. The leases, which were made decades and decades ago, were of course unfair to Hawaii because they only brought $1 to us. It was a token lease, and I'm projecting over $10 billion of resources that should come just for the Army leases alone, that arrangement. $10 billion of cleanup and energy and housing would be very good for us. So that's the approach I take. I still want it to be a discussion. I still have expressed that it would be far better to not do a kind of a fast condemnation. They got that message. They slowed down their push a little bit. There's a thing called the NDAA, which is the National Defense Authorization Act. It passes every year and it gets updated. And it's required, they have to put language in there if they want to accelerate federal land acquisition. And that did not happen this December. So it's a year delay. I want everyone to hear that loud and clear, at least, where we can have these discussions. Our advisory council can take extra input. I can take extra input from places like the HEC and the legislature and from OHA and from, of course, all the people that are on my team and all the people in our state, frankly. It has to be somewhat reasonable, because if I come back with an unreasonable counter proposal or position, look, they have the legal capacity to do this. We checked with our attorney general's team, who are great and doing a great job. They've confirmed that technically the military can do these things, which are called condemnations, and take land for fair market value, which is very little money. I wouldn't want us to lose out. So that's why I say they could do that, but we've put it off at least a year.
What's the next step? I know that you folks have been exchanging letters, but when will there be a face-to-face? Because it's already the end of November.
Yeah, we've been exchanging letters, and just to make sure that we are on exactly the same page, but I can tell you I also have direct conversations with some regularity directly with the Secretary of the Army. And that helps us a lot. So we're on the same page. He has his hands full anyway right now because he's off working on some of the national challenges that the Trump administration is trying to address. And international, I should also say. They're working on some of the questions in Ukraine and Russia and so on. We are not front of mind, and we are on the same page that we can spend this year with our teams talking about this. They've assigned a group of people to go over all the different possibilities of what it would look like if the military is going to stay and utilize that land. But at the same time, we're going to be getting this input. We already had a meeting, I believe it was yesterday, the first meeting with our council. I will attend the second or third meeting. And believe me, I get updates every day about this. This is a very important thing to us. It will be beneficial for our state to have this process, because we'll come out in a position that's stronger over time. I don't think people should expect the military to go away. I don't think that is a particularly likely or sound scenario. However, I do think that they will understand completely at all times what it means to be part of our Ohana, what has to happen with Red Hill, what has to happen with all these different military-related projects here in the state. And it's my job for this generation to be thoughtful but also firm. And that's what we settled on.
Well, switching gears on you, is there anything you want to say about the green fee development with the Justice Department looking at this cruise line pushback?
You know, right now the Attorney General is vigorously defending the legality of our act. The only thing that's being challenged is whether or not the cruise ship piece, which is about 10% of it, is legal. It is legal, I can tell you. They just don't like it because they don't like the idea of paying taxes like other people have been paying them. But I can't get into too many of the details because they're litigating this thing. I will say this. We know that we're on firm footing on this decision. I will also tell you that irrespective of what happens with this lawsuit, the rest of the green fee is intact and not being challenged. That's for all the visitors that come and will spend 0.75% fee tax on their stays at hotels, short-term rentals, and so on. It will bring in just short of $100 million if they end up taking the cruise out. It'll be over $100 million by a little if they stay in. And now we've already had several billion dollars of asks. We are able to turn that $100 million into a lot more money with bonds. And these are great proposals. Jeff Michelina, who's an avowed environmentalist and a great thinker, is working with people like Jeff Wagoneer and Chris Benjamin and so many other leaders that we've been working with on this to put projects into the community that are going to actually protect our reef, that are going to make fire breaks more real, that are going to put technologies in there to keep us safe, to deal with sea level rise. All the things that we wanted to do forever, but no one could get past, we did it. So I'm grateful to the legislature for passing this. I was honored to sign it. And I got to tell you, the rest of the country's governors are in awe of what we did because we actually took environmental action against climate change. It's going to help us. And these projects, which are going to be known as green fee projects, they're going to light it up. They're going to be good people, like a whole generation of environmentalists, young environmentalists, getting to get their projects funded when we could never do that before. And I hope that the most environmentally savvy people really embrace this. There are groups out there that have somehow maintained a little bit of an animosity to our administration because we've been pushing so hard for housing. And I would hope that they would see this as something that never was done before and now is going to fund all the dream projects that were out there. So I'm not going to name them because I don't like fighting when it's Thanksgiving weekend, but the weekend after Thanksgiving, I'm happy to be meaner. I just think that we're really trying to do good things for our environment, and it's palpable. These are real projects. Look for these in the coming year.
One last question. Anything you want to say about the water situation in Maui? Because we know that the land board put off a decision about East Maui long-term water leases, and then there's the issues with East Maui and the golf course.
Yeah, it's really tough, right? Because water is life, especially on Maui. Seaworm has a very hard job to do, and I know that this report was long awaited for Lahaina. There's a couple things. It's a complex situation. We have to have enough water to saturate the land so we don't have more fires. We also have to have enough water dedicated so people can rebuild their houses. Remember, 561 owner-occupied houses were destroyed by the fire, and another 1,873 houses that were rentals were destroyed. So you've got to build back 2,400 houses. We put together the village Kalaiola with some of that water, which is a stopgap for 5 years. But we need to build housing, and we have to be also sound in our decision-making for farmers. Seaworm is the point group for this. They will enable, with what they've done, some better regulation, especially in West Maui, because now Lahaina is essentially a water management area. And we're just going to keep doing our best. I know, again, these are the hot buttons that plague every administration. Mine is no exception. And we just had the additional heartbreak of the Maui wildfire 2+ years ago. We have to do better on water. A couple things that I'm proposing quietly is some of the more affluent players in the region, I've asked them to sort through their differences instead of being involved in a lawsuit. I also have asked them to partner on a desalinization plant to do desal, turn salt water into clean water, which takes energy, and work together to add water. I would also like to see people use R1. That's water that is not potable and drinkable, but use that kind of water for things like golf courses or roadside grasses. It's not too stinky and it will work, but you certainly can't drink it. And so we can make more potable water available as we rebuild houses, and we can use this R1 water for other needs. But I can tell you, it's still going to be a conflict because we are short on water overall. And we were dangerously short when we had the Red Hill incident. Water is going to continue to be a big issue for us. Food security is going to keep being a big issue for us. Housing is going to continue to be a huge issue for us. And that's what you're going to hear me talk about when I give the State of the State address in January. These are the top of mind issues for us as a state.
All right. Thank you so much, Governor, for your time.
Thank you.
That was Governor Josh Green, just back from the Western Governors Association meeting in Arizona, who we talked to earlier this morning. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership, providing full-service wealth management on Oahu, Maui, and throughout California. Learn more at thericepartnership.com.
Do your friends describe you as a wordsmith? Do you have a knack for digital media? HPR is looking for a communications and digital marketing manager to join our membership team. If you're a team player, able to work across departments, and are committed to HPR's mission to inform, inspire, and connect, go to hawaiipublicradio.org/jobs and apply today.
Support for HPR comes from Maui Divers Jewelry, featuring tropical pearls, Hawaiian black coral, and gemstones in Made in Hawaii creations at locations across the islands and online at mauidivers.com.
When it comes to housing discrimination, changes at the federal level could limit protections for some and put more pressure on the state to address possible cases of discrimination. Here to talk about this is HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizuo. Good morning, Ashley.
Good morning.
So what do we need to know about these changes?
Yeah, so the Department of Housing and Urban Development at the federal level rolled back protections for housing discrimination related to sexual orientation, gender identity, and English language proficiency. So the way that HUD goes after these types of discrimination cases is through the Fair Housing Act, which is a federal law that prohibits discrimination in the rental, sale, financing of housing based on race, color, sex, religion, national origin, familial status, and disability. And then states as, like Hawaii can offer additional protections, which it does through the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission. So when a person is facing housing discrimination in Hawaii, they really have two main administrative avenues that they can go through. That's the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission or through HUD. And if there's legal coverage at both the federal and the state level, the case would be filed by both entities, both HUD and the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission. And when you look at how the Fair Housing Act has been enforced previously, you know, sexual orientation and gender identity fell under that protection of sex, and English language proficiency fell under the protected section of national origin. But there has been changes in the guidance from HUD on how it's going to administer the Fair Housing Act going forward. It's rescinded the guidance that was previously issued that put, you know, gender identity and sexual orientation under that protected class, as well as English language proficiency. So here's Hawaii Civil Rights Commission Executive Director Marcus Kawakatachi.
Normally, there was no question. I mean, if it's the same protected basis, if it's within the same time period, then yes, we would dual file it with HUD. We have seen, and I think this is something that is unclear to us, actually, is there may be cases that come to us where we don't know whether HUD will take it on and dual file the case. And so we'll just send it and see what happens. So cases based on, I know, sexual orientation, as well as gender identity and expression are some which we've been told, I mean, would not be dual filed with HUD.
And to be clear, you know, Director Kawatachi is not speaking for HUD itself. That's just like according to the published guidance on HUB's website, which is revoking that previous guidance and orders for enforcement of those types of cases. So this means basically that, you know, people who are filing here may, and across the country, may have more limited options when it comes to going after these types of forms of discrimination. And now the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission would be the ones that would have to now go after those types of discrimination cases. And, you know, further complicating these types of matters is that President Donald Trump's also put out an executive order attacking disparate impact claims. It's a long accepted legal theory where a policy may seem neutral, but in practice, it unintentionally discriminates against a protected group. And those cases are also no longer being accepted. I wrote to the HUD to ask about some of these changes, and the spokesperson wrote back saying in an email that HUD is restoring the Fair Housing Act to its core statutory mission and will continue to uphold the law.
So it sounds like, yeah, we're going to focus on this and not going to focus on that. I mean, that's the approach.
Right. They're narrowing the scope of which types of discrimination that they're going to now proceed with going after and investigating. And when we're looking at what this means for people with housing discrimination cases, I spoke with Alicia Pitts, who's the Honolulu Consumer and Housing Managing Attorney at the Legal Aid Society of Hawaii. You know, she works with clients through both the HUD and the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission housing discrimination process. And she says if HUD is no longer, even if HUD is, you know, no longer pursuing these cases, it's common that a person is not being just discriminated for, you know, one particular thing. And so people should continue to report.
Even though HUD seems to be pulling back on some of its obligations and narrowing the scope of many of the types of housing discrimination it is looking at and kind of moving forward with, the last thing that I would want is for people to stop reporting it, because then realistically they have a reason to say, oh, we don't need to do this type of case anymore, or we don't need to fund this type of enforcement anymore because we're not actually getting a ton of cases. So I do understand that it can be an incredibly frustrating and long-term process. I do hope that folks still feel encouraged and emboldened to report these things, because without it, realistically, it's only more likely that there will be further pullbacks of protections for the Fair Housing Act.
And then the state laws that govern the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission do have a lot more protections than what is under that federal Fair Housing Act. And it covers all of those cases that HUD is now excluding. But Kawatachi says that means that more people will only have the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission to turn to in some cases, because, you know, logically, if there were two places that people could go and now there's only one, then the one entity is going to get a significant more amount of cases. And, you know, the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission has 23 staffers that are investigating over 400 cases, wow, a quarter of which are housing discrimination cases. And another impact of HUD no longer accepting these types of cases is that the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission has a work sharing agreement with the agency. So for every case it closes with HUD, the state commission gets federal funding. In fiscal year 2024, HUD awarded funding for a total of 13 cases of discrimination related to sexual orientation, gender identity, and disparate impact. And in total, Kawatachi estimates that federal funding accounts for roughly 20% of its budget. And if there are reductions in that, it would mean not filling positions or needing to look for alternative sources of funding. So because of these federal changes, Kawatachi wants the state legislature to extend the statute of limitations for when a person can file a claim from 6 months to 1 year to match the federal standards.
We just want to make sure that people don't fall through the cracks. It really would break my heart to see people come to us and that be the scenario where they did everything right. Basically, they did the research, they went to the federal agency, and then for whatever reason, they're not able to be assisted. And at that point, we have to tell them, I'm sorry, the law says we can't assist you either. And it's so important to me because, I mean, what we provide as a service to the public is an alternate to engaging with the court system, which is very difficult for a layperson to navigate. Also, you know, it might require the hiring of an attorney, which is something that many people have a problem with financially. And so we provide a free service, we provide information. And so that's one thing that I don't want to be affected by any impact on the federal side, is I still want our public to be able to come to us and receive the type of service and timely service that the people of the state deserve.
Do we know why the state time limit is shorter than the feds?
That's just how the state statute is written. And so because of that, that's why people will sometimes go with HUD over the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, because mm-hmm. they've extended past the 6 months that is currently written in statute, which is why they want to extend it to the 1 year to match the federal standard.
Okay. All right. Well, it'll be interesting to see. But thanks so much for flagging this.
Thanks.
That was HPR's government reporter, Ashley Mizuo. Check out her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. For the first time in baseball history, a player born in Hawaii is set to manage a major league team. The Los Angeles Angels recently hired a retired catcher, Kurt Suzuki, to lead the organization in 2026. The Wailuku native and Baldwin High School graduate will lead the baseball team with which he ended his career. The move feels like a natural fit, as Suzuki has spent the last 3 years since his retirement as a special assistant to the Angels' general manager. He recently talked with the Conversation's G.W. Gibson about his approach to managing and how his earliest days playing the baseball game on the Valley Isle still influence him.
I'm really excited to get going. You know, we've been busy filling out the coaching staff, kind of starting to look at players via free agency, trade, whatnot. So it's fun. It's definitely a different change, but it's something that I'm really looking forward to and I'm enjoying myself right now.
Yeah. Well, yeah, definitely a big change. You had a long career in baseball as a player. I'm curious to know, when did you first know I want to be a manager? Is that something that you always carried as a player, or is that something that developed more recently for you?
Yeah, I think it wasn't like when I was playing, I was saying, man, I'm going to be a manager one day. You know, I was so focused in my career, what I was doing as a player. And as I got older, as my career started, you know, you could feel it sort of coming to an end. You kind of dabble in the ideas of what you're going to do post-playing career. And just with my position, running the game with the pitchers, that type of thing, it kind of was something that I didn't, not necessarily to say that I was, you know, expecting to do this by any means. It was more of, this interests me. It's something that I've been thinking about. And then moving to the front office role the last 3 years, kind of seeing the game from a different perspective, definitely kind of changed my thoughts about, you know, do I want to manage and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it seems to be a key element here, too, where you got to know this organization, the Angels, near the end of your career, where you were contemplating that time of transition and maybe had on a slightly different thinking cap there, or a slightly even different role on the team.
Yeah, you know, when you get older, especially being in my position, being a catcher, you're game planning, you're seeing the whole field, you're seeing the game from a different lens. You definitely think about it. You know, like I said, you know, thinking about the bullpen moves that the manager is going to do, or when you're sitting on the bench watching other guys hit, say, hey, maybe you do a hit and run, or, oh, it'd be good to bunt here or steal, or whatever it is. You start thinking about the game organically. And it's not about like, oh, I'm trying to manage, so I'm going to think about what the manager's doing. It's more organically just watching the game, being excited in the moves that could be made, and just thinking along, which I feel like helped me as a player to be able to think along the game like that. And it just, yeah, like I said, it's just something that excited me. And it's, you know, now we're here talking, I'm being the Angels manager and going with this. And like I said, I couldn't be more excited for the opportunity.
Well, so you've played for so many managers over your career. How would you describe your approach to managing, or what you anticipate your approach to managing will be in terms of communication and tone?
Yeah, I think communication's always a big thing, whether in sports, whether in life, family, whatever it is, right? Communication is always a big thing. For me, I've played this game a long time. I've played for a lot of different managers. You know, I've heard the, oh, this guy's a player's manager. This guy's, you know, this and that. I don't want to necessarily label myself in that type of, I guess, category. But what I do is I'll bring the energy every day. I'll communicate with the players. I understand relationships. I understand personalities. And I say this a lot, is through a season, you go through maybe 20, 30 pitchers throughout a season, and they all have different personalities, and you have to learn how to connect with each and every one of them. And I feel like that's one of my strengths, is being able to connect, whether you're the number one starting pitcher or you're a minor league call-up getting called up to the major leagues for the first time. I feel like I have such a broad range of being able to relate to each and every player. One, because I wasn't a superstar like the Aaron Judges or the Hall of Famers. You know, I had to find ways to keep myself in this game. And I feel like that's a strength of mine that I can use to my advantage.
And in terms of how you describe reacting to each player and figuring out best ways to communicate with them, and also talking about not wanting to be put in a box in terms of what kind of manager you are, it sounds like there's something ahead of you in terms of feeling it out as you go and discovering what the clubhouse, what the team will be like day by day as it takes shape and you get to know the 26 guys that will be playing for you.
100%. This game is built on failure. As we all know, the guys that really understand the game of baseball is built on failure. And I was actually just talking to my bench coach yesterday about it. He's managed for 11 years in the major leagues, was a bench coach for the Mets the last 2 years. And we're talking about mistakes, right? As a player and as a manager, in this game, you could make the perfect move, bring in the right pitcher for the right spot, and it might not work out more than 50% of the time. You could do something that is totally off the cuff that guys are going to question you, and all of a sudden it makes you look like a genius, right? Just like you can have the perfect swing, the perfect contact with the ball, and you can get out, right? This game is built on failure. And I think the best advice he gave me was you can't dwell on every single move that you make that doesn't work, because there are going to be a lot of moves that doesn't work, and it's the right move. So learning by mistakes, learning what you could have done better. And like I said, I've got no ego. I understand there's going to be a learning curve. I'm going to try to make it short as possible, but there is going to be a learning curve, and I'm not naive to that. And we just got to keep going and getting better each and every day.
Well, you had a long career in the major leagues, but you were known to the people of Hawaii long before that, having played Little League Baseball here and grown up here. Any managers you can remember from your earliest days here in Hawaii that really shaped you and how you might learn from them and translate the work ahead of you with the Angels?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of influential coaches that I've had throughout my career, whether it was when I was in T-ball, growing up to Mustang, Bronco, Pinto, right? And I don't want to single people out or not include people. So I want to be very careful. But I would say the impact that my high school coaches had on my career probably shaped me into the player I am today. It was when I was at Baldwin High School, you know, it was John Viella, you know, Kahai Shishido. Those two guys were like, I guess, mentors in sort of sense. They played in college. They understood the game of baseball, but they also understood being a good person, doing the right thing, being pono. They understood all that stuff. And it instilled in myself where towards the end of my career, I was talking to one of my teammates that played for a long time. He said, you not have to just be talented to stay in this game a long time. You also have to be a good person, a good teammate. And I think everything correlates, right? Having the right values, it correlates to success. And I couldn't be more grateful for the mentors, the coaches that I've had throughout my career.
Well, I know you were born on Maui, and there's a particular, I mean, I think there's a tradition throughout Hawaii for baseball, I think, but on Maui in particular, Little League teams advancing to the Little League World Series over several years. Do you get a chance to stay connected with the youth baseball at all in the islands?
Of course. I mean, a lot of guys that I played high school with, their kids are playing. Those Little League teams that went to the Little League World Series, they're from my hometown in Wailuku. So all the kids, I know their dads that were there, and I went to school with them, and I played with them. I played against them. So there's definitely a lot of talent there on the island, and it's just about opportunity, right? It's about opportunity. It's about exposure. It's about being able to travel these far places and the sacrifices that the parents make. Me being a parent now, understanding the sacrifices you have to make for your children to get them to these places is huge. And I think that it's such a special thing being a parent, watch your kid succeed at such a high level. And like I said, the talent there in Maui, in Hawaii in general, I think it's starting to become more nationally known, where a lot of Hawaii kids are going to these big D1 programs across the country and making a name for themselves.
Yeah, definitely. Well, final question for Angels fans here in the islands, excited about the upcoming season. Give us the scoop. What kind of team can we expect? What style of play do you hope your team brings to the field?
I like to say I like to style it after myself when I played, but I know that's unrealistic because everybody is themselves. What I do tell people that ask me these questions is my team that's going to go out there, you're going to expect them to play hard till the last out is made. You're going to expect them to be attention to detail, to have the grinder grit mentality, and to give it their all. You know, that's the things that we can control, right? We can't control throwing a shutout, you know, winning the game, getting four hits. We can't control that type of stuff. But what we can control, the controllables that we can, we will. And I think that's kind of an important but simple approach to the game each and every night.
I feel like we saw this play out in the recent playoffs, right? Fundamentals, those small things that we talk to little leaguers about, became crucial factors in the playoffs. We saw that time and time again.
Yeah, really, you can't make it harder than it is. This game is really hard, right? And if we focus on the, I gotta get this, I gotta do this, it becomes even harder, which makes it nearly impossible to succeed at this game. So if we can control and stay within the things that we can control, like I said, which is attitude, effort, the mentality of the game, then we'll give ourselves the best shot to win each and every night. And if we don't win, we can look in the mirror and say we did everything that we could. We just didn't come out on top tonight. We got to get them tomorrow. So I know it's pretty vague. It's pretty easy to say, harder to do, but that's the best way to try to look at it.
Kurt Suzuki, new manager of the Angels. We're cheering you on in the season and look forward to tuning in. Congratulations.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
That was HPR's D.W. Gibson talking with Kurt Suzuki, the Wailuku native and new manager of the Los Angeles Angels.
Support for HPR comes from the ALS Network. In this holiday season, helping families affected by ALS celebrate connection. Year-end donations accepted at givefamily.alsnetwork.org.
Aloha, I'm Derek Malama. Please join me this Friday for a special Mele and Mo'olelo Hanaho featuring some of my classic Kanikapila Sunday interviews. We'll hear music from Kuwana Torres Kahele and Raiatea Helm. Plus, we'll get you in a festive mood with Christmas music by Amy Hanaili'i. That's this Friday at 11 on HPR One.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. On our Manu Minute today, our bird is the picture of elegance until it starts to run. Thanks to the Macaulay Library at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, we've got the calls of the sleek but sometimes clumsy cattle egret. Patrick Hart of the University of Hawaii at Hilo campus has what you need to know about these Manu.
Cattle egrets are those bright white birds with long yellow legs and bills. They're often seen along roadsides and fields, and especially love to sit on the backs of horses and cows. They were introduced to Hawaii around 1961 to control flies, but are now widely found around all the main Hawaiian islands. Cattle egrets forage for just about any animal they can swallow, but are considered harmful as they can be flight hazards at airports and are nest predators for some native Hawaiian water birds. You can often hear the calls of cattle egrets as they fly overhead in flocks to their roosting areas at the end of each day. For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Patrick Hart from the Biology Department at UH Hilo.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. For more than 8 decades, fostering community values that work to protect Hawaii's native birds and ecosystems. Learn more about membership and other ways to help at hiaudubon.org.
This is Catherine Cruz, host of HPR's The Conversation. Whether you live in our state or far from our shores, you'll know what's happening in Hawaii with the Daily Hour exploring news, science, history, or culture in the arts. Ensure that you'll never miss a show by subscribing to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or Google. You'll get the latest discussions right on your phone or mobile device. For details, just head to our website.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA. For over 87 years, committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Ukulele virtuoso Taimane has a lot to be thankful for. This summer, she performed with the San Francisco Symphony before some 25,000 concertgoers. Her latest single and music video called Princess Pikake honors Princess Kaiulani and is out on major streaming platforms. We also heard her on the airwaves as a guest on the national NPR radio show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me when they taped here in Honolulu. The Conversation's Lillian Song caught up with Taimane in our studios to talk story and enjoy some impromptu tunes during this season of gratitude. Taimane starts us off by playing a song she calls Creating As We Go.
That was beautiful. Your musicality just comes through. People in Hawaii who have grown up with you busking on the streets and then being discovered by Don Ho. You started really young. So being in music for your whole life, it is just so fascinating to see you each time, the iteration of you, how you've matured, you have new projects under the belt. What would you share with people who are following you that maybe they don't know about, you know, that other side? I mean, the day-to-day reality. I'm like, Taimane, how do you travel so much and still have, you know, this pep, this energy? What are you doing?
You know, it's, you know, it's going to sound pretty cheesy, but it doesn't feel like a job. You know, it's something that I really am passionate about. And when I say that, I'm also thinking of the hardest working musician that I know here on the island is actually Henry Kupono. He is a machine. You know, like I see him gigging more than I do. And I see him at the airport and I'm like, oh Henry, uncle, you know, you've been doing this for a while, and he just loves it. So to be able to see someone, you know, at his age and at his experience, I strive to be like that. And for him, again, he just loves it. It's just being able to do that, but also still, you know, have the work ethic to come, you know, at 12:30, you know, make sure you're on time, make sure you're professional, but also allow yourself some grace. And what I mean by that is allowing yourself to put something out in the world musically, creatively, that maybe it's not 100% to your, you know, perfection liking, but still allowing yourself to just get it out. And I think that's also very important, because I do new songs that are, you know, sometimes they don't work out perfectly, but I think the audience also connects with that humanness.
You're so honest in what you do, and it's really fun to watch your shows. And even at the Wait Wait, you debuted, what was it, the Addams Family theme song?
Yeah.
Was that on the fly?
You know, it was. So, yes, I did the Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me, and, you know, I was like, maybe I'll bring my ukulele, but I didn't really even think of it, like, really, like, oh, you know, because there was no sound check. I was just like, whatever. So I just put one in my car. I actually have a car ukulele that I just leave in my car, and then I practice, you know, when I have time. And so I was just like, they probably won't ask me, you know, it's probably big production. But then I got there, and they're like, yeah, let's do it. And so, yep, the Addams Family was the current song cover arrangement I was working on, and I was just like, I gotta go for it. You know, and hopefully I've practiced it enough. And I think people really appreciate that risk, too, for the most part. So,
and just looking at some stats, over 50,000 views already on the video that you released later.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that week I ended up doing the Addams Family in minor key for all my lovely musicians and people who love sad music. I made the Addams Family, which is actually a major, into minor to make it even scarier. So I ended up dressing as Wednesday Addams in my video and playing the song. So I get a little theatrical with it. But after doing the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, you know, in front of hundreds of people, I felt comfortable enough that it was ready for social media. So thank you, everyone, for that. Yes.
Oh, very nice. And with your travels, what is it like when you are somewhere else? Like, what is one of your international shows that you can share with our listeners about a time where you're traveling and performing, something that you've done that you can enlighten us with?
The thing that I like most touring is actually when I get to meet all of my fans after the show. So I always go to the merch table and meet everyone and, you know, if they want me to sign something. And so being able to hear their stories of how long they've driven or, you know, what the music means to them and just seeing that appreciation. And also they want to share their city, the best things of their city. So being able to have the advice from a true local who really wants to share their city is my favorite part. You know, because touring, you know, you're going from one city to another city and it can kind of blur. But what makes it special is those conversations after each show and just seeing their appreciation for coming, you know, all the way from Hawaii to around the world and hearing, you know, what the music means to them.
For people to meet you in person, it's always so different from seeing somebody on, you know, on screen or just listening to your voice on the ukulele or you singing now through the headsets. And coming up on November 29th, local fans will have the opportunity to see you in concert. Tell us about that.
Sure. So Thanksgiving weekend, Saturday at 3 p.m. So you guys, it's a little bit earlier, but we're still going to have some fun. I am going to be playing at the Blue Note Waikiki, as well as have a couple dancers, again, give you that immersive experience. And I have been touring a lot, and I will be touring next year. I'm doing my longest tour ever, which is 2 months straight. So I'll be gone again. So this Blue Note show is just, you know, I want to be able to have fun. Where I come from, again, is Waikiki. So being able to just have a good time, you know, get into the holiday season, it's just going to be a fun show.
As we are in the season of gratitude, interesting times that we're in, and you as just a citizen of the world, you probably also see different things happening, different systems.
For me, being able to hold on to our community during these times, being able to come together and share music and share stories is really, really important at this time. And to also, you know, let's get off the social medias and just be able to like be present at a fun community event, I think is really important at this time. You know, being able to look at a person's eyes and connect in that way and to like re-examine what gratitude means, I think, is things like this, you know, talking to one another and connecting through community events, I think is really helpful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And coming up in 2026, you are going to be joining a international, I guess, guitar night tour, but you're going to be the first ukulele artist joining this guitar tour. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Sure. So they're called International Guitar Night, and they have been around for decades. And I'm one of four other virtuoso musicians. They all play guitar. So there's three guitarists, and then there's me. And so we're each going to be taking a 15-minute solo set, and then we collaborate. Mm. And so it's going to be a fun jam. We're going to do duets, and then we're going to do a full quartet. And you know, an International Guitar Night, they've been doing this for so long. They have like really big audiences already. So this 2-month tour is all over the U.S. in January. We're starting in Alaska, ending in Boston. So it's a big honor for me to be the first ukulele player to be a part of this really well-renowned program, you know, and to really show what the ukulele can do. And I'm really excited to jam with these other virtuosos. Yeah.
Congratulations on that, Taimani. And really so blessed to have you back in studio. So maybe one more song?
Sure. So this is Asturias, the classical song, but then I kind of tweaked it. And so I'm just kind of reconfiguring it in a way that I think speaks to me, just in a different way.
Was ukulele virtuoso Taimani and the Conversation's Lillian Song. Taimani will be performing at the Blue Note Hawaii this Saturday at 3 p.m. And you may have heard her heartfelt rendition of Joni Mitchell's Big Yellow Taxi during this year's Hawaii International Film Festival, which was featured in the documentary A Paradise Lost. Special programming for the Thanksgiving holiday and the day after, but we are back to talk golf in a call-in show on Monday. What are you thankful for this holiday season? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us next week for more of The Conversation, and have a happy Thanksgiving, everybody.